Welcome back to the Valley of Elah. If you don't know what I'm talking about, perhaps you were not with us last week, and let me tell you that we are following one of the Bible's best-known stories, found in 1 Samuel chapter 17, page 288 in the Bibles in the seats there, the story of David and Goliath. We're taking the rather unusual course of following this story in four installments. And you may reasonably ask, why? Why come back for 4 weeks to hear a story that many of us have known since we were five or even younger? My guess is that not many of us who were here last week were really wondering what's going to happen next, or at least how is this story going to end up? So why take the time to hear this story so carefully? I have two reasons for doing it this way. The first is that we might come to a fresh appreciation of the brilliance of the Bible's narratives. A great deal is lost when a Bible story is transferred to a children's picture book, and if that is how we've become familiar with this story, there is much for us to appreciate. We're taking the time to appreciate the subtleties and the details and the context of the story, and I'm hoping that you'll enjoy this story all the more as we take the time to take it in. The second reason, or justification if you like, for giving such attention to such a well-known story is that it is so much more than a story. Like everything in the Bible, the account of what happened to Goliath is part of the Bible's astonishing message about what God has done in the history of the world to make himself known and to call people to himself. And we're taking time to see how what we call the story of David and Goliath is part of the news of God's dealing with the whole world, including us, news that comes to its climax in the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so, last week, in installment number one, we saw and heard the great Philistine monster Goliath in the Valley of Elah. And we saw how he is part of a very important Bible theme, the theme of the enemies. We saw that as the people of Israel faced the threats of Goliath as he thundered them across the valley, we all face the threats of the enemies. Ultimately, they are death and sin and the devil. Now, in installment number two this morning, the Bible theme we are going to encounter, I've summed up in the title that you see on the light blue sermon notes that you have in your papers there, The God of the Unexpected. The Bible calls us to put our trust in the God of the Unexpected. God can be trusted, but he will act in ways that take us all by surprise. His ways are not our ways. While he is all-powerful and there is no power in all creation that comes close to matching his power is made perfect in weakness, as he once told the Apostle Paul. In other words, God accomplishes his powerful purposes of making himself known and of overthrowing evil and destroying the power of death and sin and the devil by means of the shameful death of Jesus on the cross. He calls people to himself by the weakness of the message about Jesus and his death. Who would think that the massive problems of the world and the troubles of our own human lives have their ultimate solution in the execution of an innocent man some 2,000 years ago? and the preaching of the news about him to the nations of the world. God is the God of the unexpected. Do you believe that? Or do you still think that power and wealth and cleverness can save us from whatever we need to be saved from? Well, come with me to 1 Samuel chapter 17, page 288 if you haven't found it yet. 1 Samuel 17, and we're taking it up at verse 12, where we suddenly found ourselves taken about 20 kilometres to the east from the Valley of Elah into the hills of Judah to an obscure little town, the little town of Bethlehem. A town familiar to us, of course, in another connection, but then just a little obscure town in the hills of Judah. We're actually leaving the drama of the Valley of Elah and all that was going on there in order to be introduced to one David. We did notice last week that David has already been introduced to readers of 1 Samuel in the previous chapter. In fact, in chapter 16, David was introduced among the sons of Jesse in Bethlehem as the one chosen by God to be Israel's new and very different king. And in chapter 16, verse 13, we heard that the Spirit of the Lord had rushed on him from that day forward. But all that was still a secret. We've heard nothing yet of David in chapter 17. We've seen the old king, Saul, and his army assembled on one side of the valley, facing the Philistine forces on the opposite side. And between the two, we've seen and heard the Philistine with his massive armour and his weaponry and his eloquent, thunderous threats. But David has not appeared, nor even been mentioned in the first 11 verses of 1 Samuel 17. So with these things in mind, we leave the Valley of Elah and go over to Bethlehem and get reacquainted with David's family for reasons that we will see in due course. Verse 12, now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The new piece of information here is that David's father was an old man. And if you've been able to take up my suggestion last week and read 1 Samuel from the beginning, you may have noticed that the sons of old men have not done well in this story so far. You might remember old Eli's boys in chapter 2. Corrupt bullies, they were. And then old Samuel's boys in chapter 8, no better. Then let's hear a little more of old Jesse's sons. Verse 13, the 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and third, Shammah. These older sons of Jesse we had already met in chapter 16. Now they had joined King Saul's army. So now we know they were among those we saw last week in the Valley of Elah who were dismayed and very afraid. You see that in verse 11? At the sight and the sound of Goliath. But what about David? We're told in verse 14, David was the youngest. Or you could translate it, the smallest. Too young or perhaps too small to have joined the army. The smallness of David among his big brothers is emphasised here for good reason, as we will see again in due course. Now, our interest in the Bethlehem family is focused on these 3 oldest boys, and especially on the small one. So at the end of verse 14, the 3 eldest followed Saul, But David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep in Bethlehem. David didn't go with his older brothers into the army. He continued to look after his father's sheep, but went to and fro from the troops under Saul's command with, as we will see in a moment, messages and packages from home. Now, these few lines reintroducing us to David, and particularly in relation to his older brothers, should remind us of what took place in Bethlehem in chapter 16, sometime previously. What happened back then gives us reason to be very interested in this David. It will also turn out to be the key to understanding the rest of this story. Despite all appearances to the contrary, this lad was the one chosen by God to be his king. By not mentioning this fact, but subtly reminding us of it, the narrator has successfully kept this crucial piece of information well in the background, reflecting the fact that it was not known or understood by the other characters in this story at this point. Now, while we've been rather calmly reacquainting ourselves with the boy in Bethlehem, we do need to remember that 20 kilometres off to the west, in the valley of Elah, the Philistine menace was continuing his performance. So verse 16, for 40 days the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. Twice a day for 40 days. Goliath repeated the routine we saw last week. But during those 40 days, a small lad from Bethlehem would be making his way to the valley of Elah, a small lad to whom we know there was more than meets the eye. In order to follow this little development, we're taken quickly back to Bethlehem again, where we may presume news of Goliath's antics had not yet been heard. It was an ordinary day in Bethlehem, an ordinary day in the life of a father, anxious about his three sons at the battlefront. And so Jesse sent David, yet once again, as was his habit, on an errand out of concern for his boys. Verse 17, Jesse said to David his son, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. And also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them. In the scheme of things, it was a menial, trivial task. The details here underscore the ordinariness of it, the unremarkable character of both David's family and the errand on which he was about to embark. Parched grain and loaves of bread were simple enough fare. A gift to the commander was the kind of thing too many fathers do to the embarrassment of their sons. The request for some tangible sign of their welfare was also altogether natural. And just so we're quite clear about where Jesse was sending his youngest, we're reminded in verse 19, now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting the Philistines, as though we could forget. Actually, I suspect these words in verse 19, just by the way, were the conclusion of Jesse's instructions to David. In other words, I think the quotation mark at the end of verse 18 should really be at the end of verse 19, remembering that in the original language of the Bible there wasn't punctuation. That's been inserted by the translators. And so Jesse told David, Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting the Philistines. You see, Jesse was telling David, perhaps for the first time, where his brothers now were and what was going on there. Now, of course, we know better than Jesse that Saul and the men of Israel were not fighting the Philistines at all. They were trembling in terror at the Philistine and his abuse and scorn and threats. But neither Jesse nor David knew that yet. And so David set out on his rather unremarkable chore. Verse 20, David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. The sort of unimportant details keep us, in a sense, in suspense. And they force us to experience things on this morning from David's point of view. Just notice this in verse 20, how it tells us more than we need to know. That David rose before he went scarcely needs to be said. That he left early in the morning is hardly more gripping. It's nice to know that he left the sheep with a keeper, but we wouldn't mind if we hadn't been told. But you see, all of this is how David experienced the first part of that day. As an obedient son, doing as his father had told him, as he had often done before. And perhaps we find ourselves wondering then what the chapter 16 episode in Bethlehem could mean. If this errand-running boy is the Lord's chosen king, if the Spirit of the Lord has come upon this lad, it's difficult to see. He appears to be no more than an obedient servant doing his dad's bidding. But Bible readers know that very ordinary situations can be the beginning of extraordinary things. So read on. Middle of verse 20, he came to the encampment. As the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry, and Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army, at least that's what it looked like to David. He arrived after his 20-kilometre trek with his considerable load, just as some action was taking place. The army was lining up along the side of the valley. There was shouting, much noise. The battle lines were drawn up. The armies were facing each other, as they had been doing day after day for many days now. This, of course, was too much for a boy to miss. Any moment now, the fighting would begin, he thought. David was too much of a boy to miss this. So verse 22, David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. Just as well his dad couldn't see him, is all I can say. If David had rushed to the battle lines hoping to see some fighting, he was in for a surprise. Verse 23, and as he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name. Remember him? He came out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. The man of the between. Goliath was being seen now for the first time. Not by us, of course, we saw him last week. Nor, of course, by anyone else in the Valley of Elah. They've seen him twice a day for 40 days now. But by David. And the Philistine monster repeated his now twice daily tirade. We heard it back in verse 10 for the first time. I mock the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. The only difference this time, and it's a difference of monumental importance, and although no one could have guessed it at the time, it's noted at the end of verse 23, and David heard him. Did anyone notice? Did anyone care that young David from Bethlehem heard him? Of course not. But this was the turning point in Israel's fortunes. It will turn out to be a turning point in Israel's history, and if we care to see it, in world history. As far as everyone on this side of the Valley of Elah was concerned, however, nothing had changed since the first time that they heard the monster of Philistia. So verse 24, really the way we finished last week, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. Just as you see back in verse 11, where we did finish last week, they were shattered and greatly afraid. In verse 11, if you notice that, I hope you have the text in front of you, you'll notice in verse 11 that it had been the hearing that had led to their terror. This time, in verse 24, it was when they saw him. Now, of course, the actual experience involved seeing and hearing on both occasions, but perhaps the mention of seeing now in verse 24 might remind us of some words that were spoken back in chapter 16, verse 7, something God said to Samuel back there in Bethlehem sometime earlier, where he said, "For the Lord sees not as man sees." The Israelites were seeing Goliath as man sees, and therefore they were terrified. What do you think Goliath would have looked like to someone who saw not as man sees, but as the Lord sees? What did the Philistine Hulk look like to God? In a moment, we will find out. Before we do, however, we hear of what Saul, remember, the king the people of Israel had chosen for themselves, what Saul had done to counter the threat from Goliath. Had he decided to go out and face the foe himself? After all, he was the biggest man in Israel. Well, not exactly. Had he drawn up a battle plan? And would he lead his troops out to deal with the aggressors? Well, not exactly that either. In fact, we do not learn of Saul's initiative from Saul himself. We just hear a rumour. Verse 25, the men of Israel said, they were saying, "Have you seen this man who's come up? Surely he has come to defy, or better, to mock Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." Now, actually, we can't even be sure that Saul had made a promise to do all this. All we're told is that this is what was being said around the place. David seems to have been unsure about this as well. He questioned the rumour. As he spoke, however, he revealed for the first time a rather different perspective on the terrifying figure down there in the valley. See verse 26, David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach or the mockery from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should mock the armies of the living God?" These are the first recorded words spoken by David in the Bible. He asked two questions. The first was to clarify the rumour. What is the reward for the man who puts an end to this mockery? The second was a rhetorical question, despising the arrogance that he had heard from the Philistine. In the second question, David sounded like nothing that had been heard from Saul, or anyone else for that matter, in the Valley of Elah these last 40 days. David spoke of taking away the mockery from Israel rather than being shattered by it. He expressed contempt, not terror, for the Philistine man of the between. He saw, as apparently no one else saw, that the Philistine, this uncircumcised Philistine as he described him, this pagan worshipper of dead gods, was mocking not only Israel, but Israel's God, who alone was the living God. And so we begin to see something of the effects of the Spirit who had rushed upon David sometime previously in Bethlehem. The Spirit-filled man was seeing Goliath differently. Could we even say that he was seeing as the Lord sees? The people answered the first of David's questions. Verse 27, the people answered him in the same way, so shall it be done for the man who kills him. But to David's second question, there was no response. Well, in fact, there was a response. It came from those closest to David, those who knew him best. Our second installment of the great David and Goliath story closes as it began with David and his brothers. In particular, it was the oldest, big, tall Eliab who did the talking. Verse 28, now Eliab, David's eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. Eliab, of course, knew nothing. He still saw as man sees. And all he could see was a presumptuous young rascal whose only purpose in coming here was to see the battle. Verse 29, David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word? Another translation captures the sense of it. Can't I even speak? And David moved away from his brothers and continued to ask his astonishing questions. You see, verse 30, he turned away from him towards another and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again as before. And as we come to the end of this installment, we might imagine the young man moving from one group of soldiers to another, uttering his preposterously defiant questions. Perhaps he seemed to many a presumptuous young rascal. God is the God of the unexpected. No one in the Valley of Elah that day, perhaps with one exception, but no one had any idea that this young man was the one through whom God would deliver his people. God is the God of the unexpected. What he was doing in the Valley of Elah was the beginning of a sequence of events that can be traced through the biblical record over the next 10 centuries. It came to its climax when a descendant of this David appeared speaking words more provocative and apparently more presumptuous than anything David had said on that day in the valley. And those who knew him best, or thought they did, those from his own hometown said, is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us? Where did this man get all these things? And they took offense at him. It was an understandable mistake, but it is a very great mistake nonetheless to take offense at the unexpected ways of God. Who would think that Jesus, the teacher of parables, the healer of the sick, who was executed for blasphemy, who would think that he is the king who will save his people from death and sin and the devil and rule the world? It is as unlikely as the boy from Bethlehem doing anything for the people who faced Goliath. To trust God, you must be prepared for the unexpected. Let's pray together. Our God and Heavenly Father, we ask that your Spirit might come upon us so that we might see things differently, that we might see our lives and we might see this world and we might see your ways, not as man sees, that we might recognise that your ways are not our ways, and that we might see human power for what it is, that we might see the security brought by wealth for what it is, that we might see what can be accomplished by human cleverness for what it is, and we might recognise that your purposes for all things have to do with Jesus Christ, the Son of David. We pray this in his name. Amen.